4KGOU, I'm Richard Bassett. Songwriter, musician, and filmmaker Luke Dick had an unconventional childhood. He grew up in and around the Red Dog Saloon, a strip club in Oklahoma City where his mom danced in the early 80s. Her experience there is the subject of Dick's documentary Red Dog, which is available Tuesday on various on-demand platforms. Dick describes the film as a retrospective on the lives of a group of people that worked with his mom and a triumphant story of parenthood and hope. I discussed Red Dog with Dick, as well as his indie rock band Steve, and his career as a country songwriter. I'd like to talk about your indie rock band Steve first.
Yeah.
Until a few months ago, you know, it was called Republican Hair. Why the name change?
We'd been a band for a few years, and I don't know what happened. A tech crisis, you could call it. The algorithms in social media started keeping us from being able to promote shows in new towns. And by then, politics had gone awry, and it was no longer fun or ironic. And so I needed a solution. And the solution became to rename the band Steve. And it was an everyman to begin with, and we just made it the Everyman Band in name. And now Facebook and Instagram aren't afraid that we are Russian bots trying to hawk political ads to the world. Now they know for a fact that we are a modest rock band traveling the world trying to make it more fun than it was before.
So you started announcing that name change, you know, before and kind of during the Scissortail Park opening night concert where you, Bronco, and Kings of Leon performed. How was that experience, you know, coming back to the city where you grew up and being able to celebrate that historic moment?
I'm still count. Oklahoma is home to me. And so, coming back and being able to be a part of an awesome show and an awesome park in a town that seems really revitalized was a really awesome experience for me. And I just was really thankful for it, and also to be able to play in front of so many Okies, which Steve has never been able to do. We've pretty new band, and so we've been playing smaller clubs, 300-400 capacity, a little bigger in Nashville. And so to come and be a part of a big show was, it was thrilling, Richard. MVIP. Bling, bling, fake spring. Got a cardboard crown, ain't it good to be king? Bling, bling, fake spring. Imagine every game and imagine every rain.
Steve has this fun, you know, energetic sound, but beneath the big drums, sharp synths, and catchy vocal lines are some satirical critiques on consumer culture, particularly the most recent singles, Fake Supreme and Clickbait.
I consume most of my news on my telephone, and in the case of Clickbait, you get duped, right? You're reading the news, and it's like you'll never believe, you know, what Heather Locklear's forearms look like. Of course, even more current and actual news than that, how it's presented in headlines. And I wanted to turn that into a pop song instead of make a folk song out of that, and to turn that into something fun, even though I think news-wise, it's honestly a little depressing to me. Here's an anecdote. I just jumped off of a video shoot for a video for Steve, for the song I Am Steve, and I was trying to find a newspaper as a prop, and so I went to 3 convenience stores and couldn't find one, and so I went to the large supermarket and I couldn't find an actual newspaper. Wow. Not even the state newspaper, but they had half a dozen Inquirers and Stars, and without thinking anything, I was just like, okay, cool, that will look good as a prop anyway. And then as soon as I bought it, I walked out thinking, wow, that's what, I guess that, is that what sells? And I thought, oh my, I hate to be this guy, but that feels like doom to me. This is the way. Sure. This is the way that we consume news. This is the most, not the way that we consume. This is the most. This is the only thing that the grocery store can sell, and so that is kind of the theme, in a way, of clickbait. Except for it's treating the material as sort of pop bubblegum as well. That song has actually recently been picked up on a new CNN documentary about the history of the tabloid. It's called Scandalous. Clickbait is the track for the credits that roll at the end. Baby, your clickbait sitting underneath my fingers. Yeah, baby, your clickbait
sitting underneath my fingers. In addition to the music you make with Steve, you are an accomplished country songwriter, penning songs for numerous stars such as Casey Musgraves, Eric Church, and several on Miranda Lambert's new album, Wildcard. Can you compare your process or your mindset when writing songs for yourself as opposed to for someone else?
When I write songs with and for other artists, there's part of it to me that's a little bit of character work to me. I'm searching in myself to something that makes sense conceptually, and I'm looking for some kind of a creative Venn diagram, bigger than just creative, but also something that resonates with me and also resonates with an artist if the song is actually being written with an artist, which a lot of times that's the case. So you're trying to both be excited about something, and what that means is maybe in country music is about the lyrics and it's life affirming in some way. And, you know, I mean, I raised kids and I was raised in Oklahoma. So I've, you know, played football and eaten apple pie and, you know, definitely have some what is considered iconic American culture under my belt. And country music has some of those themes, and so it comes to me naturally. And so I'm always looking for ideas for songs, or once you start writing songs, the ideas appear to you a little bit more on a daily basis. And so you look for these, and then when somebody steps into your room, if it's somebody like Miranda or Eric, to me, I want to be ready to write with somebody of that caliber and have an idea that I think that would resonate with me and would resonate with them. And sometimes they come in with ideas and I'm helping them in whatever way that I can, musically or lyrically or whatever. And so it's definitely a co-creation process. That's how I write songs with and for other people. There is definitely me in those songs, but you know, Steve started happening 3 or 4 years ago. And the more that I wrote for it, the more that it was working in this one little part of my brain. And there aren't as many rules about it. To me, rock music can be apathetic if you want it to be. Pop music can be apathetic if you want it to be. I don't consider myself an apathetic person. But to say that is to say that you can take on many perspectives in something like indie rock. And so I don't think that a song about clickbait and treating that like a weird teeny bop love song would work in country music as a song. I couldn't go and pitch that to an artist and have that work on country radio or on a country record or anything like that. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I don't in terms of my own art project. And so I don't know where it fits or exactly how to get it out to everybody. Like in country, they take all their songs to country radio and then it goes out. And there are, of course, many other artifices of publicizing. But in indie rock, you make the song and then you start playing it for people, or you put it up on iTunes and Spotify and Amazon and see if people respond to it, see if it gets on a playlist, see how people listen, look at all the numbers. But even before that, it's just you make something that you love and then just put it out there and have fun. Try to love it, you know, every line. Try to love every line. Amuse yourself, get at something a little bit. Let that idea of something like clickbait, or in the case of the song like I Am Steve, what is this weird little existential crisis of happiness. How do we, what is happiness? How do we get there? I don't know. You know, let's do our best. Having fun in absurdity, I guess, sort of this sort of reveling in absurdity. And that is, that's Steve.
Steve in the morning, Steve in the eve, Steve in the mirror looking back saying, who is me? I am Steve.
You know, you are a longtime musician. I'm wondering about the genesis of the Red Dog documentary. Was filmmaking something that always interested you, or did you just kind of fall into this project?
My mom had sort of told me little stories here and there, and I'd always thought it was fascinating. And I was always curious about the human side of that, you know. It's easy a lot of times in regard to that line of work to demoralize it or cast it in a certain light and not pay attention to the human aspect of it. These are people who are falling in love or having hopes or having dreams and having kids and having lives. And that was in the back of my head. I had started working with a little iMovie program in 2008 or 2009 and just realizing the potential of music and film working together and thinking of music in that regard, in regard to stories. I mean, songs are sort of little mini stories sometimes. And I was intrigued and really had really desired to make something. And I started, when I moved to New York, I found a film partner who is actually another Okie named Casey Pinkston. And he had just gotten a little camera. DSLR cameras had just come out and they were relatively cheap and easy to use and produced a really quality image. And so I bought my own camera and studied composition. And even before that, I had interviewed my mom, audio interview, to try to create something that could be on like This American Life or, you know, Radio Lab or The Moth or something like that. I was a big fan of those shows, and I'm a big fan of unique stories, I guess, sort of unlikely stories for broadcast. And so I'd had her tell me a few stories, and then I cropped them together and submitted it to This American Life. And Nancy Updike had reached out to me, said, I really like this. I think we should produce something. And so we started production on a piece for This American Life. And in the middle of that, I had started also filming my mom, and just knew after I got her on film how comfortable she was, how compelling she was, how charismatic she was, how heartwarming she was, that this was a bigger project. And that was probably around 2010, 2011. And so I just said, look, can we put a pin in the audio story? I think I need to devote time to making a movie out of this, and then we can come back and after the movie's done and we can revisit an audio story. And so that was 2010. You know, here we are in 2020, and the film's done, and it's coming out to the public. And it's been a long road, and I haven't really drugged my feet on the project. I just had other things going on and thought, well, I'll do it when the door opens for it, time-wise and opportunity-wise. And so that's what happened eventually over the years, is that the schedule opened up, opportunity opened up. We ran a Kickstarter to pay for some animations, which served as the sort of dramatizations of the past, these sort of fun and weird and funny dramatizations of the past. And so we ran the Kickstarter. It was a big success and kind of a regional viral thing in Oklahoma. And then we finished the movie. It took us another year or so to finish the movie and get all the post-production. But it was essentially a three-man crew with some other friends who helped with cinematography and B-roll and stuff like that. And then we had a film that we took to film fests and debuted at South By, and then ran 8 or 9 film fests and won a few. We won Best Documentary at Dead Center, and then Best Historical Doc at San Antonio Film Fest. and had a lot of fun and learned a lot of things. And it was extremely gratifying. I'm excited to actually get it out to the public now.
The documentary does focus heavily, you know, on the Red Dog Saloon, a cast of employees that met there in the late 70s, early 80s, their relationships and struggles. It is a poignant and emotional film, kind of about parenthood and family and people wanting to make a new life for themselves and their children. I'm curious what you might say to someone that would be hesitant to watch Red Dog, since it, you know, revolves around a strip club.
Yeah, sure. I feel like one thing, anytime I watch a reality show about, say, the Bunny Ranch in Las Vegas or outside of Las Vegas, a brothel or a movie about a strip club, it's super glitzy and sometimes unrealistic as reality shows can be. And what I wanted to do, what Casey and I both wanted to do, was to actually try to capture the full dimension of people. And I was interested in some dancers who are on the whose arcs are portrayed on the film being 70 years old, and what it's like to look back and to see your life as an arc of sorts. And I don't think that the Bunny Ranch does that. Not that it's not entertaining in its own way, but that's not what our film is. I would like to think, and I mean, my perspective is one of a quirky artist, but it's, I think that it's sort of a heartwarming family tale. Of course, it's rated R in the context of language and nudity and the nature of the work, from all the women. But that doesn't make it any less human or any less heartwarming to me.
Kind of has these qualities of an ethnography, you know, it kind of explores a certain sect of society and casts no judgments, offering a way to understand the group of people and hopefully empathize with them and their circumstances, I think. And so
Thank you. It's great. That was the intention. And, you know, you try to be objective and you try to just show people for what they are. And I know a few people along the way that we interviewed were thinking that it was an expose or something like that, and that was far, far from the intention. It was really meant to portray and to be a retrospective on a group of people's lives, and hopefully, you know, a triumphant story of parenthood and hope in an unusual circumstance and an unusual setting.
How, if at all, has your relationship with your mom changed since you finished this project?
My mom and I have always been close. I mean, we made a movie together, and we spent so much time interviewing, and there's something uniquely, you know, intimate about following the threads of your mom's love lives as she was a young person, and also, you know, what made her tick as a parent that you just can't ask or can't know when you are younger until you have a few kids and start to really feel the gravity and the reality of the experiences of parenthood and love and loss and all of this. That when we got to the movie, it just became such a special thing for me. And I loved when it was on the calendar, I'm going to go do this weekend. And it was a little bit of a pain for her, not because of what it required in regards to telling that story. She's an open book. That's easy for her. But for us to set up camera and set up shop in her house or her back porch or whatever, it was a pain for her, and it was annoying to her. So I would inevitably just wait till the week that we were coming and say, all right, Mom, can you film this weekend? And then we went to Film Fest together. And so she would get up and do the Q&A with me down in Austin and in Oklahoma City and maybe one or two others, where she came. And I don't know, you know, I hate to put thoughts in in her head or misrepresent it, but I just feel like so many people got so much from the film that it became something that was validating to her. And people hugged her like she was their mom and they loved her. And as a son, you know, it's of a mom who's had a pretty hard life, if you were to put it on paper. That was extremely gratifying to me and made me feel like the whole process was absolutely worth it. The resulting film produced the desired effect in regards to how people viewed the situation. And to have people really respond to my mom in a positive way, I'll just never, ever regret spending all that time and being such a pain when we're trying to come up with something great and revealing and honest and redemptive. And so it's just an experience that is a highlight so far, one of the highlights of my creative life for sure.
So Red Dog, and really the Miranda Lambert single Bluebird you co-wrote, are rich with these themes of rebirth or wanting to create a new life. At times, it's dark and sad, but there is positivity and hope there as well. I'm just wondering, does that come naturally or more consciously, subconsciously or consciously for you in your art, given your unconventional upbringing?
Yeah. All I know to do when I'm making a song or making a movie or making anything is to try to like it, and then more so to try to love it. And the only way that I seem to be able to love things is that there is ambivalence there. You know, there may be a little ambiguity there. Parenthood, for instance, in the case of The Red Dog as a theme, parenthood is weird to me. Parenthood is weird because I feel like I'm faced with some sense of hypocrisy every day. You tell your kids not to do something that you've done. You tell them to follow things that you've not followed. You know, do as I say, not as I do. I think that every parent does that. And I can't, you know, for some reason, I can't get past that strangeness of being a leader or a parent or whatever. And so I have a hard time not checking myself when it comes to being an authoritarian. I don't think that just because someone's an authority means they're a moral authority on anything. And in regard to songs, I just never gravitated toward things that were overtly positive. For some reason, experiencing a song or art that was overtly positive never seemed to be telling the full story to me. I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, something like Wind Beneath My Wings. Very lovely song. Millions and millions of people love it, but it's not the one that I dialed up to relate to my own experience. And so the love songs that generally come out that resonate with people from me or wind up on people's records are the ones that have this ambivalence to it, because that's how I experience life. You know, there's like, it's not perfect. You know, love isn't perfect. Parenthood isn't perfect. Life isn't perfect. Even if you make it and you're on top of the mountain and you make loads of money, your life isn't perfect. And so that imperfection always finds its way into whatever I'm making, the songs, you know, the lyric, the whatever. And I can't get away from it. And anything else seems inauthentic or like I'm pandering in some way, you know. And I don't know why, but that is just how the aesthetic developed. And that's what I do now.
That was Oklahoma-born songwriter, musician, and filmmaker Luke Dick. You can find this conversation online at kgou.org.